Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Free Expression with Jerry Baker.
Hello and welcome to Free Expression from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jerry Baker, editor-at-large of the Journal. If you're not already subscribing to this podcast, please do sign up at Apple, Spotify, or indeed wherever you do your listening. This week, let the general election games begin. Super Tuesday is done. We're now just less than 8 months away from Election Day, and the long and presumably brutal campaign for the presidency starts in earnest. In the end, it was only American Samoa, Vermont, and Washington, D.C., between them representing a grand total of 0.4% of the American people who declined to opt for the apparently inevitable rerun of the 2020 presidential election this year. Yes, that's right, on the least suspenseful Super Tuesday in modern history, Joe Biden lost the Democratic primary only in Samoa to the hitherto unknown businessman Jason Palmer, but otherwise romped home. The Republicans' Nikki Haley secured a narrow win over Donald Trump in tiny Vermont, having notched a victory in Washington, D.C. a few days earlier. But Trump, of course, won all 14 other contests. Overall, Biden got his total vote share in the Democratic primary to 86%. Trump's was around 65-66% in the Republican primary. The next day, of course, Nikki Haley bowed to the inevitable, ending her campaign, but declining to endorse Trump, at least for now. So the general election we always knew was coming has come. Biden was set to deliver his third and probably most important State of the Union address Thursday night. We're recording this on Thursday afternoon. Many of you will probably have heard that. Whatever he said in that is clearly going to have to use that speech as a kind of a launching pad to shore up his perilous position ahead of November's election. He starts this campaign in as weak condition as any incumbents in the modern era, standing at an average of 39% approval, according to Real Clear Politics, way behind where previous presidents who won election were. He trails Trump in head-to-head polls, but of course, most critically, not in those national polls, but in seven key swing states, all won by Biden 4 years ago, Trump is ahead in all of them except Pennsylvania. So what can we expect in this election? Can Biden possibly turn it around? Will Trump's legal perils, even after the attempt to have him removed from the ballot by some states, has been rejected by the Supreme Court, will those somehow legal problems still derail him? Well, with me to discuss all this week is Tony Fabrizio, leading pollster and political consultant in a long career. Fabrizio has been pollster for presidential campaigns from Donald Trump in 2016 back to Bob Dole in 1996 and many others in between. He is a partner at Fabrizio Lee & Associates and is, with Democratic pollster Michael Bosian, half of the pair responsible for the regular Wall Street Journal poll, which, of course, is published in the pages of this great newspaper. And Tony Fabrizio joins me now. Tony, thanks very much for joining Free Expression.
Thank you for having me, Jerry.
So the election we all kind of knew was coming, some feared was coming, seems to be here finally. Super Tuesday seems to have laid any final doubts to rest about the identity of the two candidates. It's Biden v. Trump, the sequel, so it seems. As we start the polling, and I want you to take us through your polling and how you see the general polling, but Biden seems to be in a fair amount of trouble, I think it's fair to say, trailing Trump in the head-to-head polls, trailing in key swing states, underwater on all the issues, underwater on his approval ratings, slightly less than 8 months from Election Day. If he does, how does Biden turn that around?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, the one thing that is different about this presidential election than most other presidential elections is voters have very firm opinions of both men. There is very little you're going to tell a voter about Donald Trump that they don't already know or surmise. In large respect, there's little that you're going to tell a voter about Joe Biden that they don't already believe about Joe Biden. So you have two candidates that, for lack of a better term, are overexposed, if you will. So you start from that premise. The second thing is that despite whatever good economic news is out there, voters still recall the Trump presidency as being a time where they felt they had more money in their pocket. They weren't being squeezed economically. Things were just better. Didn't have a border crisis, didn't have two wars raging in the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to be very difficult for them to kind of reframe all this. And the notion that they're going to you know, educate voters about Donald Trump is kind of silly on the face of it. Now, can things change? Sure. Voters tend to rally around the president that's in office if there is a national crisis. Things could change in terms where there is a surge in the economy or something changes with the border crisis or something like that. But at this juncture, they have an uphill battle. They are on defense. We are on offense.
Dig into it, and especially into your polling. And as I said in the introduction, you, of course, with your Democratic counterpart, do the polling for the Wall Street Journal. One thing that is quite striking, and again, I know some polls recently have put Trump up above 50% in the head-to-head. They do seem to be generally sort of outliers, but your polls, most other polls, do always seem to suggest that Trump, however weak Biden may be, Trump does seem to have a ceiling of around, you know, that 46, 47%, which of course is, you know, roughly approximately what he got when he ran in the previous two presidential elections in the national vote. Is that the right way to think about it? Is there just there's a hard core of Trump voters, but there just is not enough voters ever to quite get him up to a majority?
Well, first, you're looking at a national poll. In today's dynamic, in a national poll, to be breaking 50 is truly, for a Republican, it would be truly monumental. When you think about states like New York and California and Illinois and Massachusetts that contribute massively to Democrat margin.
I think only George W. Bush in 2004 was a Republican who broke 50% in the last 30 years, right?
Right. It's very difficult to do. So when you look at it from that perspective, but I would say the following, you know, the rule in polling for people who practice it in campaigns like I do is the incumbent's going to get what the incumbent's going to get. And the bigger problem is that Biden has a hard time breaking 45. And further, when you dig into the numbers, Trump holds more of his 2020 vote that Biden holds of his 2020 vote. And in a lot of these states, it's not going to be a head-to-head race. It's going to be a multi-candidate race. Arian, you're going to have a Greek candidate. And if you believe the news reports, you may even have RFK Jr. on in a lot of these states. And, you know, there's debate about whether he hurts Trump, whether he hurts Biden. At the end of the day, I would put money on that he ends up hurting Biden, that he ends up hurting Trump. And that makes it problematic because what happens is the people who don't like Biden and Trump tend to gravitate more towards the third party candidates, where that's a group where Biden had won in 2020. So that hurts Biden more than Trump.
What do you make of the argument in we've had the primary contests, which are now, for all intents and purposes, over since Nikki Haley withdrew this week on the Republican side. In the, whatever it is, about 20 or so contests we've had, Trump's been getting around two-thirds of the total vote cast, which is obviously comfortably more than enough to win, but does suggest that there's a solid number of Republican primary voters who just aren't going to support him. And if Trump can be viewed as an incumbent, he was the president, and in his own view, he should still be the president, but that's quite a high number voting against the prohibitive favorite, the de facto incumbent. Now, you know, against that, we have to weigh the fact that your polls and other polls all seem to show Trump in terms of polling getting a regular 90% or so of Republican identifying voters. But do you think there are any warning signs from these primary votes and these primary results for Trump?
Well, first, this is a myth that was created, and by the way, very craftily by Democrat operatives on Twitter.
We've seen those crafty Democrats do this before.
They're very good at this. I mean, that was very good. You know, I mean, Tom Bonier and people like that, who generally I respect for their acumen at reading polling. The fact of the matter is that if you go back and look historically, let's look George W. Bush or even Donald Trump. Donald Trump, 2016. Donald Trump is getting double or more what he received in every one of these contests. Did he have trouble uniting the Republicans when it came time in 2016? No. George W. Bush. I mean, if you look at Super Tuesday, I read Karl Rove had a comment that the Trump campaign needs to be concerned about these votes Nikki Haley's getting. Well, Donald Trump has gotten more votes in every state than George W. Bush did against John McCain. Were they concerned? I mean, it's, you know, it's conventional wisdom. It's a theory in search of facts from my perspective. Again, I go back to when you look among their partisans, Biden and Trump get basically the same thing. They're both 90 or above. And not only that, Trump is holding on to more of his 2020 vote than Biden's holding on to his. And when you look at the groups that are switching or that are softening, it is Hispanics. Biden won them handily. Trump right now, depending on the poll, in the latest Wall Street Journal poll, Trump was up by one. You look at African Americans. This is the second poll that we've done for the Wall Street Journal where Trump was at 22% among African Americans. That's double what he got in 2020. I mean, you just go young voters. Joe Biden won them by 26 points in 2020 in the Wall Street Journal poll, which included an oversample of voters 18 to 29. Donald Trump was only losing them by 10 points. So if anybody has softness in their base, it's Joe Biden.
All right. Since you raised him, let me channel my Wall Street Journal editorial page colleague, Karl Rove, and sort of see what he might say in response to that. He might say, well, we get that. And we've seen in previous Republican primaries, you know, the voters have come home, even those who voted for the candidate who wasn't the eventual nominee. But there are two things that are different. First is Trump is a probably uniquely polarizing candidate. I remember the 2000 presidential campaign very well, Republican primary. And I don't think McCain voters viewed Bush in the way that many, many Haley voters view Trump. And I think they are just very different characters. And secondly, the polling does suggest, and again, you tell me whether we can believe it, that a large number of those voters just say, and again, I don't think this was the case in 2000 or in 2012 when Romney won the nomination, or McCain in 2008. I don't think that the people who didn't vote for the eventual nominee said in quite such explicit terms that they will not vote for the nominee. Now, are we just being misled by that?
I don't know that they were looking for it in 2000 or 2012. I don't know that they were asking those questions. A different dynamic. And I'm not blaming the pollsters who did the polling at that point in time. But I think there is this theory that there is a group of Republicans. By the way, there is a group of Republicans. Is it a large group of Republicans? No. But there's a group of Democrats who won't vote for Joe Biden, too. And if you look at the Haley voters in these states, New Hampshire, South Carolina, when you look at them, most of them voted for Joe Biden in the 2020 election. And they were independents or Democrats. So, I mean, the fact of the matter is, did Haley attract people into the Republican primary that normally didn't vote in the Republican primary? Absolutely. Are there Republicans that maybe preferred Haley over Donald Trump? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, the choice is going to come down to Donald Trump or Joe Biden. And even the Republicans who don't necessarily like or voted for Nikki Haley and may not be the biggest fan of Donald Trump, they like Donald Trump a hell of a lot more than they like Joe Biden and his policies.
Back to our point about the third party candidate, is it going to be a contest between Joe Biden and Donald Trump? You've already said, you know, RFK Jr. is out there now, I accept. And certainly the polling suggests that he draws, he's drawing around 10% of the vote, maybe a little more from Joe Biden than Trump, or not much more.
Actually, our latest Wall Street Journal poll had him drawing a little bit more from Trump than Biden.
Is that right? That's interesting. So he's out there. There's continuing talk, and maybe it'll never happen. There's this sort of kind of the mythical no labels ideal candidate.
Yes.
Nikki Haley herself has been mentioned in that, though she's ruled it out. Kristen Sinema is out there this week having announced her resignation from the Senate, the classic kind of, you know, bipartisan former Democrat turned independent. I mean, Kennedy is a unique figure with, you know, let's be honest, some sort of slightly kind of maverick qualities, and it's not clear exactly what appeal he has. But how much of a threat is kind of a genuine middle of the road, bipartisan, Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema type figure? How much of a real possibility is that, do you think, in terms of a campaign?
You know, first of all, you're creating a scenario in a perfect world. And perfect, I use the word in quotes, okay? I use it advisedly. Where you're going to make it to election day, and whoever that third party candidate is not going to be defined by either side or both sides, okay? So saying Joe Manchin is a moderate, well, okay, right now maybe to some voters. First of all, that assumes he's known to voters nationally, or Kristen Sinema.
By the way, Manchin's already ruled himself out. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I am talking about a theoretical candidate.
But right. And so let's talk about one that's in the race. Okay, let's talk about Kennedy, right? Who's not only in the race, but clearly, according to his super PAC and others, say that they've collected enough signatures to be on the ballot in crucial swing states that Biden and Trump both need to win to get to 270 Electoral College. Well, let's talk about that. Only one side's filed lawsuits to try to keep them from collecting those signatures. Biden. DNC and Biden people, because they know what we know. And that is, at the end of the day, put aside RFK Jr.'s vaccination position, which is what he got the most attention for lately. You go down the rest of his positions. I mean, he is an ultra liberal when it comes to environmental issues, when it comes to taxes, when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to foreign policy. Just go down the list. I mean, this guy wants to put the executives of oil companies in jail. I mean, that's not necessarily Republican positions or Republican.
No, as I said, we can rule out the idea that RFK Jr. is any kind of a centrist.
Yeah.
He does appeal to Trump voters.
Because of the vaccine.
Because it is that. Is it that? Yeah.
It is. And does that mean it's going to stay that way? Absolutely not. And the Biden people and the DNC are smart enough to know that once he starts talking, they've got a real problem because the rest of his positions do not line up with Republican dogma. In fact, they much more line up with AOC and the squad and the progressives of the Democratic Party. So it's a real problem. But I will tell you, there has always been this, why can't there be a third party centrist? Everybody hates the two candidates, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I've been doing this a long time and I remember Ross Perot. I remember all of it. And at the end of the day, one is the two political parties make it really tough for third parties. And it makes it really tough to get the money. And what No Labels is seeing here is that it's really tough to recruit somebody that can actually carry the banner. It's really tough to get that bipartisan ticket. I mean, one of the things Nikki Haley said, in order to take the No Labels nomination, I would have to run with a Democrat, and I'm not going to do that.
We're going to take a short break there. When we come back, I'll have more with Tony Fabrizio, Republican pollster. We're going to be looking at the prospects ahead for the election and digging really deeply into questions about who's going to vote and how critical the turnout will be in the presidential election in November. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
You're listening to Free Expression with Jerry Baker. Don't forget, you can listen to the latest episode anytime on your smart speaker. Just say, play the Opinion Free Expression podcast. Now, back to Jerry Baker.
I'm back with Tony Fabrizio, partner at Fabrizio Lee & Associates and part of the team that produces the Wall Street Journal poll every month. Very quickly on some of the issues, Biden is way underwater on immigration. Maybe the economy will improve a bit. That may help him. What seemed to work well for Democrats, at least in the 2022 midterms, you talk to Democrats and they tell you this all the time, is abortion and democracy, right? Abortion particularly. And you tell us about your polling, but it seems pretty clear that Democrats have an advantage on that. I know it depends how you ask the question and how you frame it and the types of abortion restrictions you have. But broadly speaking, it seems to have worked for Democrats, both in House and Senate races and in ballot initiatives. How big a concern should that be for Donald Trump?
Well, first, understand that people tend to live by their last success in politics. And that ignores the fact that every election is different. Every election is different. And there are different dynamics that come into play. So in 2020, I remember we did a survey for the Wall Street Journal when I was still doing with John Anzalone, who is President Biden's pollster. And we did it before the Dobbs decision came down. And voters were kind of like, yeah, we're more concerned about the economy than we are about the abortion thing because it was theoretical. It wasn't actual, right? It hadn't happened yet. Yet a few months later, we took another poll for the Wall Street Journal, and the world had changed. While the economy and inflation was still important, what had happened was is that abortion basically was like a defibrillator for the Democratic base and for more moderate female voters. It kind of woke them up. Now it went from being theoretical to being actual. And what does this mean in my state? Well, fast forward. We've had 2 years now. And states have passed their own laws and people have come to terms and elected people in and elected people out based on it. And so the threat isn't as imminent as it was in 22. Okay. And so that's number one. Number two is there are other issues that have come to the fore. And so is it still an important issue to Democrats? Yes. In the latest Wall Street Journal poll that we did, we ask a question that basically tries to figure out what is the one issue that you'll vote against somebody on, okay? And the top issue is still abortion rights, but that's at 22%. Right behind it is immigration at 20%. So what's happened is other issues have kind of filled that void. Before, that number would have been higher back in 2022. We asked the question a little bit differently, and it was higher. But what happens is, if you look at it by partisanship, the top issue, more than a third of the voters that say would be the top vote against issue, if you will, if a candidate disagrees with them, is immigration at 36% and abortion is the top issue among Democrat partisans with 36%. And when you look at independents, a key group that both sides always wants to persuade, it's basically split 50-50 between abortion and immigration. In 2020, that was not the case when it was economy. Abortion gained ground with independents. So I think the playing field is different in 24. I'm not saying that it's not an issue that the former president won't have to address. But again, it doesn't have the same potency. And there are other issues that are competing for mind share, if you will, with the voter. And now January 6th, you raised January 6th.
Just before we come to January 6th, just on abortion, because yeah, you say the former president has to deal with it. And again, it's complicated because, of course, there's not really going to be a federal. I mean, I know there is some pressure from some Republicans for sort of federal legislation on abortion, but it seems pretty unlikely. But Trump does seem, I think, to be fair, it has to be said, a pretty broadly, widely held consensus view among American people that something like a 15-week, 16-week limit on abortion, you know, in terms of the age of the fetus of the baby in the womb, 15, 16 weeks, which is very much in line with, you know, other countries. Most of Europe has that kind of a rule.
20 weeks, yes.
20 weeks, you know. But that does seem to garner a lot of support. Do you think that is politics by Trump? Do you think he's hitting right in the kind of sweet spot of where most people are?
I haven't spoken to the president about this. As you know, I'm working for the Super PAC, so I can't talk to him about this. But in my previous dealings with him in 20 and even in 16, he has always been more of a consensus guy on this issue. And what I mean by that is...
Well, he was once famously described himself as pro-choice, so he's come around on that, right?
Yes, he has. But I think what you'll see, and again, I'm trying to look in my crystal ball here with no necessary, you know, just knowing the way the world works, is that's what he will try to do. The key on an issue of abortion is... And the Democrats, again, were very, very good on this in 2022, was to make our position, the Republican position, extremist. Yet, when you move to a 15 or 16-week position, and then you start comparing that with some of the Democrat positions, there are a number of Democrats who favor it all the way through 9 months. There are a number of Democrats who favor it past 24 weeks or to 24. You know what I'm saying? Having that trade-off, given that the political gravity on this issue centers in that 15, 16 week, because most people are uncomfortable once you get past a certain point of time, allowing it, even with exceptions, you know, life of the mother, rape, incest, et cetera, et cetera. Where they're uncomfortable on the side that we take is when we get it down to 6 weeks or 8 weeks. And so it all depends on where the gravity lies here. And while I think the Democrats can use abortion to energize their base, okay, the fact of the matter is the average voter going to be sitting there when they go to the polls in 2024, given everything else that's going on in the world right now, and say, you know what, abortion is going to be my top issue that I'm going to decide. Right now, it's basically tied with immigration. And there's a whole bunch of issues that come after it.
All right. January 6th, let's move on to that. Again, that's the other issue that Democrats are going to push very, very hard. It seems that, you know, we've seen Biden do that already for the last 3 years. He's going to push it even harder. Trump, you know, we're not now clear now exactly what's going to happen to his Georgia case, which seems to be in disarray because of what the prosecutor got up to down there. The Jack Smith case against him on this, on the election case, is kind of seems to be in a little bit of a legal limbo with the Supreme Court reviewing the immunity issue and others. But, you know, this is still going to bubble on. And a lot of people were very, very uneasy, rightly so, in my view, about the president's behavior after the last election, what happened January 6th. How big an issue is that going to be in the final analysis?
Well, I work with a number of Democrats on other projects, corporate projects and other projects, and I have a great deal of respect for a number of them. One of the people is a gentleman named David Axelrod, who I'm sure you know. And in response to the Biden campaign's thrust or theorem on the race, that by November, the top issue in everybody's mind is going to be January 6th, his response was, you know what? I'm really not sure that the family in Scranton is going to be sitting around the kitchen table on the day before Election Day debating about January 6th.
But let's interrupt you there. Okay, maybe not the family in Scranton, but what about the woman, mother, suburban mom, well-educated with a college degree, who has reservations about Trump, doesn't like Biden, can't stand what's going on with immigration, doesn't like what's going on in the country, but aren't there some voters there?
Maybe they vote third party.
Okay.
And who would they have normally voted for? Biden.
Yeah.
Let me put it this way. The Wall Street Journal, in our last poll that we did, not this past one, the one before, and the New York Times, I know I don't want to name a competitor, but it's the more recent example of it.
Never heard of it, but there you go.
Okay. Yeah, that publication, the gray lady, I'll refer to it. They ask a question, and we asked in the last survey, the previous one in December. Basically, I'm paraphrasing, Trump committed a crime, right? He's guilty of a crime. He committed a crime, whatever. And in those surveys, roughly a little over 50% said that's true. In both the Wall Street Journal survey and the Gray Ladies survey, of the people who said he committed a crime, in the Wall Street Journal survey, it was like 9% or so. In the New York Times survey, it was like 11% of those people that were still voting for Trump. And when the Wall Street Journal reporters went and questioned those people, and they did a story on it back then, questioned those people on callbacks, well, you said this, but why are you voting this way? It was very interesting because at the end of the day, there's a presumption that voters think that one guy is really more honest than the other guy in politics. That's not the case, okay? And what is important to them at the end of the day? And what they found is the economic issues and other issues were more important to them at the end of the day. And so they had to make a choice. It comes down to a binary choice, and they made the binary choice.
All right, Tony, one final question on what we might kind of call the theater of the election. And then I want to spend the last few minutes digging into some of the minutiae of the polling and specifically who votes. But the question on the sort of what we might call the theatrics, vice presidential pick, we assume Biden is stuck with his. And I don't think that's insignificant, by the way. As you know, knowing Biden's age, it seems to me is not only a problem, it's the fact that he must have a fairly high chance of not finishing a second term, and his second term would be finished by someone I think voters have very, very little regard for. So that's an issue there. But on the Republican side, Trump's got to pick his. I mean, I know you used to work for him, and I know you now work for the super PAC. You're not involved directly in the campaign, so you know you can give me an insider-outsider view. But does it matter who he picks? What kind of person do you think he should be picking? And indeed, do you want to throw out any names?
I think he himself has put out a lot of names.
Yeah, we've seen this Apprentice show before, haven't we? Yeah.
Everybody from Ron DeSantis. At one point, Nikki Haley was in that group. And I think that there's a lot of people who would love to be it. But I think at the end of the day, you know, I was the chief pollster in 16, and so I was involved in the conversations about VP. And that Donald Trump is a very different Donald Trump than 2024. He was a political neophyte. Now comes to the process, having been president, having seen, you know, how it works better, you know what I'm saying? And so my guess is he's going to be more circumspect in the pick in 2024 than he may have been in 2016. And so that tells me he recognizes that a VP candidate can only do harm. They very rarely add anything. And so while there are symbolic choices he can make, the truth of the matter is that Donald Trump is a political phenomenon that no VP candidate is ever going to overshadow. And the only way they overshadow Donald Trump is if they say something that gets in trouble.
Yeah.
So I think that there are a lot of people. Well, I don't know if there's a lot of people on the list, but I would guess that he's going to look for someone that he feels shares his beliefs, that is a true MAGA candidate, someone that he feels is going to be loyal, and someone that he feels is going to be a staunch defender of him and his policies. So, you know, you've got a group of people that could be definitely on that list. Tim Scott, a J.D. Vance, Marsha Blackburn, you know, there's a whole bunch of people in the Senate. And certainly there are several people in the House, you know, Byron Donald.
Does the gender ethnicity thing come into play at all, do you think?
I think it would be interesting. But again, I don't know that it's determinative. I mean, if you had somebody that fit all the other criteria, it would do you no good to pick a candidate that would be symbolic that's going to cause you problems, right? So you pick a female. Let's say you're looking at Kristi Noem or you're looking at somebody like that. If there's going to be a problem and it erases the gain you might make, then what's the purpose of it? You know, I've done this now. This is my sixth or seventh presidential race that I've been involved in. And I don't know that at the end of the day, it's no longer the case where the vice presidential candidate is additive or you're picking somebody for a demographic play. Joe Biden didn't get more of the black vote because he picked Kamala Harris.
All right. Final question, Tony. It's really a fundamental question about turnout and who is going to decide this election? Who's going to vote? Barack Obama was able to win in 2012, despite the odds, by seemingly mobilizing relatively kind of low engagement voters did just enough to come out and vote for him to defeat Mitt Romney. We saw this explosion in turnout in 2020, driven, of course, by easy access to voting through mail-in and the special provisions that were put in place for COVID and all of that. My question is, what should we be looking for in terms of overall turnout, what that means in terms of the total votes? And I know, obviously, with, you know, state by state is what matters here, but the overall turnout, we think we're in this position where a lot of Republican voters are now the kind of relatively low-intensity voters, you know, tend to be college-educated voters, seem to vote in greater numbers, and we know that Democrats have an advantage there. Give us a picture of what the electoral turnout this year is likely to be and how that will impact the result.
Well, first, reading it today is, again, a survey is just a snapshot of a picture in time, right? It's not predictive for 8 months, certainly not the case. But I will tell you, looking at the likely turnout scenario is it doesn't look like turnout is going to go down in 2024. In fact, it may nudge a little bit more. And the reason for that is that if you look at both parties and their partisans, so we ask the question, you know, definitely vote, probably vote, 50-50 chance of voting, et cetera, et cetera. 95% of Republicans say they're definitely going to vote. 92% of Democrats say they're going to definitely vote. So on the partisan scale, I mean, that's virtually everybody that says they're going to vote is, you know, in each of those partisans, they're going to vote. There's very few probable voters or 50-50 voters there. When you look at it in terms of now you start looking at it by groups beyond the partisan groups, and you start looking at it like, let's say you look at white voters versus African-American voters. Well, here now you see some difference. 90% of white voters say they're definitely going to vote. 83% of African-American voters say they're definitely going to vote. So now you see some differences. So you could see that the Biden people need to turn out, even though Trump is getting a large percentage of African-American votes, they still need to turn out a group they're going to win 70-20. Then let's look at voters under the age of 30, which is a group that they've always touted and how they're going to be this great turnout mechanism. Well, guess what? Their likely vote number compared to an overall likely vote number is double digits lower. So they're 16, 17 points lower to say they're definitely going to vote than overall. And they are 20%+ less likely to say they're going to vote than, say, voters that are 50 plus. So there are groups where there is softness that would require a greater effort on the Biden turnout machine than necessarily the Trump turnout machine. When you look at it by interest level, we ask a follow-up question, what their motivation is, their interest in the election, and you see similar, you know, we rate it on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being extremely motivated or interested. And you see here again, Republicans are at 83% interest motivated, 10 level. Democrats are 80. So again, not statistically significant, but guess what? It's enough that when you're looking at individual states that were lost by fractions of a point or a point or two, that can make a huge difference in a number of those states. Because remember, we're not playing a popular vote game. We're playing an electoral vote game. It could make a difference. And again, you see the same type of drop-off that you saw in the vote likelihood, where younger voters are less interested, African-American voters are less motivated or interested. Again, problems. When we do both sides, the Democrat pollster and I both do a what we would call a GOTV group for Trump and those that are less likely to say they're definitely to vote in Biden's. And Biden's group is bigger. He's got more voters that are kind of soft voters, if you will. And I don't mean soft in terms of their commitment to him. I'm talking about soft in terms of their likelihood to vote.
We saw, what, 160 million voted last time, I think?
158.
150. Okay, so you think it's going to be more than that?
It could edge up a little bit more, yeah.
So who gained? With that big turnout, I mean, we know Biden won by, what, 7 million votes last time. And again, I know there are a lot of Republicans who don't believe that, but at least according to the official numbers, he won by 7 million votes. So another big turnout, does that mean, again, you're looking at that kind of advantage? Or if the turnout is bigger, are you turning out, from what you're saying, maybe more Republican voters?
Well, a couple of things at play. One is that they're going to be voters in that 158 million that are going to switch. Again, I told you that in the Wall Street Journal polling and in other polling and other publication polling, media outlet polling, that Trump is holding on to way more of his 2020 base than Biden is holding on to his, okay? So that's number one. Number two is when we do these surveys, we do them based on a registered voters list. So we know the person we're talking to, what their vote history is. And the interesting thing is, the most frequent voter, the voter who, say, voted in the 22 election, the 20 election, the 18 election, and the 16 election, what we'll call four fours, Biden has a slight edge over Trump. The less frequent voter you are, okay, the more Trump's advantage is. If you're the least frequent voter, the more advantage Trump has, which suggests, and they're screening in and saying they're going to vote, okay, which suggests that the higher the turnout, the more that benefits Trump.
That's really interesting. So you've almost got a kind of a curve, like a kind of an unconventional curve where Republicans are favored with low turnout, the Democrats with higher turnout. And then when you really get going, even beyond maybe where we were in 2020, once again, Trump gets the advantage.
But you pointed that out before when you said, well, you look at a college-educated female, right? You look at college-educated voters who are more likely to vote than those who are less educated. Well, that's what's at play there. There is a correlation between all of those things.
Fascinating.
Where Trump dominates with voters who are college or less and Biden college plus, right? I mean, so it's part of the entire dynamic that's changed.
Really fascinating. Tony Fabrizio, I could go on all day asking you these questions. That was really fascinating. Tony Fabrizio, thanks very much for joining Free Expression. We'll have you back between now and the election, I'm sure.
Whenever you'd like, Jerry. Thank you for having me.
Thanks very much. That's it for this week's episode of Free Expression. Thanks very much indeed for joining us. I'll be back next week with another deep dive into one of the big topics facing us and facing the world. In the meantime, thanks for joining us and have a great week.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.